The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, I'm Derek Frost for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading from the Triangle Business Journal. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with the headline for a special section. Leaders in Diversity. These companies and individuals push diversity and inclusion efforts within the workforce, resulting in higher morale and profits. As there are numerous articles on companies and people, we will read the first from each section. So first, from the giant company of the company honorees, LexisNexis Legal and Professional. What are your most notable accomplishments in the past year in diversity and inclusion? Received widespread awards and recognition for our commitment to a culture of inclusion and diversity, signed the Business in the Community Race at Work Charter, and is committed to its 5 calls to action, received a perfect score on the Human Rights Campaign Foundation's 2021 Corporate Equality Index, or CEI, measuring corporate policies and practices related to LGBTQ workplace equality. LexisNexis also earned designation as one of the best places to work for LGBTQ equality. Best CEO for Diversity 2021 from Comparably. Also from the same publication, Best Company for Culture 2020, Best Company for Diversity 2020, and Best Company for Women 2020. Meanwhile, RELX, of which LexisNexis is a part, is a signatory to the Women's Empowerment Principles, a UN Global Compact initiative, is a member of the Open for Business Coalition, a group of leading global companies dedicated to LGBT plus inclusion, and is a signatory of the Valuable 500, a group of companies committing to placing disability inclusion on their leadership agenda. Over 80% of managers have completed unconscious bias training. And Rhonda Moore, Chief Inclusion and Diversity Officer, is a founding member of the Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Board. What are the greatest challenges in implementing a diversity and inclusive policy? Our team serves customers in 160 countries. There is complexity in addressing a complex topic like diversity with so many global nuances. A global and guiding principle has been to focus on creating a culture of inclusion for all of our employees, one where employees enjoy psychological safety and feel they can bring their entire and authentic self to the workplace. Given the unrest over the past year, will you change your strategy related to diversity and inclusion initiatives? The past year has underscored the importance of our mission of advancing the rule of law around the world. We condemn discrimination and racism in any form. We are committed to eliminating systemic racism in our legal systems. How has COVID-19 impacted your overall operations? Throughout the pandemic, we've prioritized the health and safety of our employees and leveraged federal and local regulations for our office operations. What percentage of your employee base are women, people of color, and part of the LGBTQ plus community? In 2020, the RELX workforce was over 33,000. Women made up 51% of the workforce, 43% of managers, and 31% of senior leaders. In 2020, 45% of board members were women. Our U.S. RELX workforce is 68% white, 9% black, 12% Asian, 5% Hispanic, 2% other, and 4% unknown, based on a sampling of approximately 90% of employees. We do not currently collect data on sexual orientation and gender identity. And there's a small recap of information about the company. CEO, Mike Walsh. Total number of employees, 10,000 plus. Year company was founded, 1970. Company description, provider of legal, regulatory, and business information and analytics. And in the large company section, local government federal credit union. CEO Maurice Smith, total number of employees, 238. Year company was founded, 1983. Company description, financial cooperative that serves local government employees, elected appointed officials, volunteers, and their families. What are your most notable accomplishments in the past year in diversity and inclusion? Our initiatives have expanded with the development of a DEI committee. The committee comprises a diverse group of staff members dedicated to enhancing understanding and participation in DEI across our organization. In addition, the committee has designed a charter to follow with measurable goals and steps to take to enhance the initiative's value. To facilitate employees embracing DEI as an internal ideal, LGFCU provided staff with resources, including training and immersion, to successfully implement a DEI philosophy. Our employees are offered a monthly get-to-know-you session with colleagues, and an internal DEI website was created. What are the greatest challenges in implementing a diversity and inclusive policy? LGFCU has policies that support diversity, equity, and inclusion in the workplace and communities where our staff and members live and work. If there is a challenge, it would be that the ideas, philosophies, and concepts behind DEI that are in the spotlight and being raised in many communities, organizations, and industries keep moving forward toward a sustained and successful ideal that DEI benefits everyone. Given the unrest of the past year, will you change your mission relating to diversity and inclusion initiatives? With the recent social climate, our company's initiative was provided further credence in proclaiming the need to focus on diversity, equity, and inclusion. Our CEO facilitated a town hall meeting that all staff was invited to attend and openly discuss social unrest taking place in the U.S. In addition, our CEO wrote an op-ed for the CU industry on the value of DEI. How has COVID-19 impacted your operations? The staff worked remotely. Throughout the pandemic, our organization's leadership provided regular updates to CU staff and members on processes and resources to assist with navigating through the unprecedented time. What percentage of your employee base are women, people of color, and part of the LGBTQ+ community? 48.2% women, 31.2% people of color. LGFCU does not retain the sexual orientation or gender identity of its employees. What percentage of your executive team are women, people of color, and part of the LGBTQ+ community? 40% women, 60% people of color. LGFCU does not retain the sexual orientation or gender identity of its employees. And we'll stop there, as there's many of those articles, and we'll come back to them at the end if there's more time. For now, we'll go to our continuing series, 52 Shades of Success. The headline, Nos Vamos Local. Raleigh high schoolers launch We're Going Local project highlighting Hispanic firms. Story by Connie Gentry. Juniors at Athens Drive Magnet High School in Raleigh, Kavya Sriam and Alana Payne, experience diversity daily. Not only at school, where 56% of the 2,075 students are persons of color, but also in their personal lives. What they don't always witness is inclusion. But at just 16 years old, they're already working to help others see the need and opportunity for inclusion. In conjunction with National Hispanic Heritage Month, celebrated from September 15th to October 15th, the girls produced the documentary Nos Vamos Local, which translates to We're Going Local, and features five Hispanic businesses in the Triangle. We're trying to spread Hispanic culture and the different struggles the owners face while starting their businesses, as well as the impact of the pandemic on these small businesses, Sriram says. We interviewed the largest Spanish radio station in North Carolina, a dance company, and an ice cream shop. Sriram, whose parents are from India, was born here and lives in Cary. Payne, who moved from Virginia to Raleigh 2 years ago, says her father's family is from the Dominican Republic. There's a lot of separation with all ethnic groups, Payne says. There are so many people from different backgrounds, but still a separation. People don't make efforts to communicate with others. I see it across all generations and groups. We have to find ways to communicate and connect better. In her estimation, there has been some improvement during the pandemic because people have been forced to make more of an effort to communicate. Sriram, who is equally committed to promoting communication and connection, disagrees about the impacts of the pandemic. I think it's gotten worse during COVID. We're more segregated than before because everyone is isolated. We aren't traveling or meeting people. That is one of the finer lessons to be gleaned from the Gen Z population. People don't have to agree on every minute detail to be able to work together and make a difference. And people don't have to know one another before they come together for a common cause. Sriram and Payne were school acquaintances before they embarked on creating Nos Vamos Local, but the friendship evolved as their mutual passion for raising awareness matured. While neither has embarked on a project of this scale before, Payne created a documentary for a PTA contest earlier this year. The documentary, a response to the assigned prompt, "We Matter Because," earned first place in the district. She brings the filmmaking expertise. Sriram brings a passion for Spanish-speaking culture and an intuitive business acumen beyond her years. Currently enrolled in an advanced calculus class at NC State University, she says she could survive in a Spanish-speaking culture, but is not fluent to a native speaker. Neither had any connection to the businesses featured in the documentary, but that didn't stop them from initiating the interviews with the owners of the businesses they chose. Vida Dulce, a dessert restaurant, La Tapatia Supermarket, Mambo Dinamico, spelled D-I-N-A-M-I-C-O, dance company, Amparo Beauty Salon, and the Lale radio station. I think what was most interesting is how they got started running businesses and how difficult it could be, Payne says. Some of them had done it before and others got into it without prior experience. The story shared in the documentary resonated with the two girls, who looked for a diverse mix of small businesses. Vida Dulce struck a chord because one of the owners, Carlos Torres, translated his experiences in Mexico to the Triangle. Carlos was entrepreneurial even as a kid selling popsicles in Mexico, Sriram explains. He moved here as an adult and brought that spirit and culture from Mexico, Payne echoes. Vida Dulce does amazing Mexican desserts coupled with Western desserts, and I like how it is combining cultures. One of their favorites is the story of how Lale operated throughout the pandemic, providing vital information to the Spanish-speaking community, many of whom could not understand the English-speaking media. Lale operated 24/7, and the broadcasters ran studios from their homes, even when they had COVID themselves, to provide news and safety information, Sriram says. As the largest Spanish-language radio station in North Carolina, our role is not only to entertain our Hispanic community with music, but also to inform, educate, and celebrate, explained Shirley Davenport, general manager of Lale. I love what these young women are doing to highlight Hispanics in our community, their struggles, and their successes. The town of Cary is also excited about sharing the documentary. Robbie Stone, arts program and operations coordinator for the town of Cary, says they are working to fit the documentary into their schedule. We do our programming 2 months in advance, so we aren't able to schedule this during Hispanic Heritage Month, but we hope to build a screening of the film into our schedule. I've seen the trailer and spoken with Kavya and Alana. Their documentary is an amazing accomplishment that we want to support. The girls aren't looking to make money from their work, and if any revenue is generated, they plan to donate it to nonprofits that support the Hispanic community. Other than their time, which was an extensive commitment given that the project spanned several weeks and the planning dated back months, they estimated the total cost of production was around $100. This was due in large part to the fact that Payne's uncle, who is a professional videographer, provided his equipment for them to use. We wanted to help small Hispanic businesses, Sriram says. I think small businesses should receive more funding and more support. They're dying out because people are shopping online and at the bigger, cheaper stores. Their solution is Nos Vamos Local to raise awareness and support for local business. And in a related A Closer Look section, Nos Vamos Local, We're Going Local, producers Kavya Sriram and Alana Payne. The video is available at youtube.com/NosVamosLocal, NOSVAMOS, local. National Hispanic Heritage Month runs from September 15th to October 15th. In 1968, President Lyndon B. Johnson established Hispanic Heritage Week. 20 years later, President Ronald Reagan expanded it to a month-long celebration. And now we turn to Biz, a quick glance at Triangle Happenings, written by managing editor Dane Huffman. 9/11 Memorial Design Unveiled. To commemorate the 20th anniversary of the 9/11 terror attacks, a new Special Forces monument is being erected and will be housed at Fort Bragg. Leading the design is Raleigh architect Matt Pearson of Ratio Design. On August 16, Pearson was in New York City to receive a 36,000-pound piece of steel from the Twin Towers that will be incorporated into the design. That ceremony included a dignified transfer from the New York City Fire Department to the U.S. Air Force's Special Forces Unit. Also in attendance was the FDNY's head fire chief. Hundreds of FDNY firefighters, representatives of the U.S. Air Force, members of the NYPD, family, and friends. The project stems from Mike Rizzuto, a former member of the Special Forces Unit, who desired to have a monument at Fort Bragg to commemorate the unit's history, hard work, and sacrifice. It is humbling to be part of such a significant design that honors those who serve our country in such a profound way, Pearson says. The unveiling of the design of a new Special Forces monument for the 24th Special Tactics Squadron took place on September 11th at Pope Airfield next to Fort Bragg. Construction of the monument will take 6 to 8 months and will need to be bid out, Pearson tells Biz. Pearson also previously designed the Navy SEAL monument in Virginia Beach, Virginia. Town of Clayton fills two top posts. The town of Clayton closed out August with a bang by filling some fairly high-profile positions. The town hired Ben Howell as its new planning director and Kenya Moore as its new director of human resources, both effective August 30. Howell, who served the past 5 years as the long-range planning manager for the town of Morrisville, brings with him 16 years of local government planning experience. Walls has 16 years of experience in the HR field. Before coming to Clayton, she served as the Human Resources Director for the North Carolina Wildlife Resource Commission for 4 years. Jet project ramping up at Global Trans Park. At the September 1 ribbon-cutting ceremony for its 24,000-square-foot aircraft painting and refurbishing facility at Global Trans Park in Kinston, private jet charter service Fly Exclusive announced plans to expand further. As part of the event, Fly Exclusive, a subsidiary of LGM Enterprises, announced it has broken ground on a 45,000-square-foot facility, an additional hangar for interiors and maintenance. This includes 7,500 square feet of workspace for the interior design facility. Currently, there are 150 people employed at the facility, with the prospect of 200 more when the new facility is complete, the release said. Jetstream Aviation, also a subsidiary of LGM, will operate the facility. North Carolina Hospital sets up mobile morgue. The Delta variant of COVID-19 is ravaging rural parts of the South, including North Carolina. The fallout has gotten so bad that UNC Health Southeastern in Robeson County set up a mobile morgue outside its hospital in Lumberton to accommodate the increase in COVID-19-related deaths in the community, according to the Fayetteville Observer. When you take a normal level of death in our facility and then layer the number of COVID-19 deaths on top of that, we're just not equipped, Joanne Anderson, president and CEO of UNC Health Southeastern, told the paper. Robeson County has one of the lowest vaccination rates in the state, as just 36% of residents 18 and up are fully vaccinated, according to a New York Times database. For reference, 69% of Wake County residents 18 and up are fully vaccinated, the database says. Triangle Breweries NAB Awards. The North Carolina Craft Brewers Guild recently announced the winners of its 2021 North Carolina Brewers Cup, and some local craft brewers earned recognition. In all, 15 Triangle area breweries received awards for their concoctions. Carolina Brewery in Chapel Hill earned first place in the alternative fermentation category for its Sky Blue Kolsch, and it earned third place in the pale British beer and bitter category for its Copper Line Amber Ale. Tobacco Wood Brewing Company in Oxford won first place in the stout category for its The Moose. Raleigh's Little City Brewing won first place in the specialty IPA category for its Mosaic Reprise. Other Triangle Area breweries nabbing awards were Trophy Brewing, Brewery Bavana, Nickel Point, Bombshell Beer, Bull City Burger and Brewery, Crank Arm Brewing, Oakland Springs Brewery, Tarboro Brewing, Molson Jar Lager Company, Fainting Goat, Vicious Fishes, and Hugger Mugger. Lower Left Brewing Company in Charlotte was named North Carolina Brewery of the Year and North Carolina New Brewery of the Year. Overall, 803 entries were submitted. And finally, it's bow time for college stars. A Charlotte-based restaurant chain is diving headfirst into the new trend of signing college athletes as sponsors. Bojangles has been busy this summer building its roster of Division I players to carry the company's image. The move comes after court rulings and the NCAA cleared the way for athletes to make money off their names, images, and likenesses. Already, Bojangles has signed players from NC State, basketball point guard Cam Hayes, UNC quarterback Sam Howell, Clemson, Georgia, and Georgia Tech, and that's just to name a few. So far, Bojangles has signed more than 70 male and female athletes across 33 different schools nationwide. Now we turn to the page on finance and corporate relocation, written by Lauren Onasorge. Hinton reveals startup. Former PowerSecure CEO quietly raises millions for venture. A stealthy energy storage solutions firm is raising money, and a familiar name is at the helm. Sydney Hinton, the retired CEO of Wake Forest-based PowerSecure, has raised $2 million in equity for his new startup, Raleigh-based Utility Innovation Holdings. He declines to detail the firm's current lineup of customers, saying only that they include utilities and Fortune 500 firms. He also declines to give specifics about headcount or revenue, answering, "We've been blessed." The company is centered around the basic needs of energy storage, Hinton says, including cybersecurity for the electric grid. "We don't have products," he says. "We have solutions. We engineer and design solutions. We're focused on building a company centered around the carbon-free grid of the future." Hinton previously led microgrid builder PowerSecure through its 2016 buyout by Southern Company, a $431 million deal. Kirkland returns to Durham. George Kirkland, a graduate of both Durham Academy and UNC Chapel Hill, is back home after all these years out of state. "Great tech companies can get access to capital outside of San Francisco and can be just as successful in North Carolina, hiring the same level of talent," he says. Kirkland first left his home state for a career in banking, spending 5 years with Morgan Stanley, before trekking to California, where he started San Francisco-based education technology firm RaiseMe in 2012. The company is in stealth mode ahead of a planned November launch. On his new venture, Kirkland says it's about rethinking part of the home buying process, effectively creating the ability for people, when they buy a new home, to digitize all of that home's information. A securities disclosure shows the firm has closed on $400,000 in debt from six investors. The round is capped at $500,000, and Kirkland says he's confident he'll close the full amount. Could COVID numbers make or break North Carolina economic development? If North Carolina can increase its vaccination rate, could it pay off when it comes to mega project wins? Maybe, a site consultant says. John Vranick, a site selection consultant with Spectrum Location Solutions, said he's already fielding questions from prospects about prospective sites' COVID numbers. Instead of looking at overall state numbers, companies are analyzing the COVID statistics for individual counties and communities where they're considering their investments. And COVID is also changing the scope of what exactly they are looking for, he says. 5 years ago, a company wanting to leave a major West Coast city, they would consider another big city, he says. However, with COVID, the majority of my inquiries deal with moving to a suburban area. Clients are looking for more space, he says. They don't want to have to get into crowded elevators with other people, he adds. And finally, in a section called They Said It, first, a quote from Morgan Creek CEO Mark Yusko, whose company invested nearly $4 million into San Francisco-based sustainable shoe brand Allbirds last year through a special purpose vehicle, one that attracted 25 investors, according to a securities filing. Allbirds says it plans to go public. "It's fun when you're involved in something you use. I'm sitting here staring at my Allbirds on my feet as I'm talking to you." And also a quote from Redhill Biopharma CEO Dror Ben Asher, talking about how conversations with the FDA led to a cancer treatment being tested to treat severe COVID-19 cases. What happened next was really a roller coaster. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the On Real Estate page, written by Caleb Harshberger. Morrisville greenlights sites. Morrisville unlocks development options with major changes. Developers seeking opportunities in the Triangle have a new area to explore in Morrisville. Earlier this summer, the town established two large areas for commercial mixed-use development within the town's historically restrictive airport overlay district. On July 27, the town council voted to approve a suite of zoning and land use changes that would allow for commercial, multifamily, and mixed-use development in two newly established districts: the Business Activity Center, and the Transit-Oriented Development District. We're very excited, Morrisville Mayor T.J. Cawley says. This was 18 months to 2 years in the making. Both sites sit in the town's airport overlay district, but will now allow multifamily and commercial development with regulations encouraging pedestrian-friendly mixed-use development in an area largely untouched by developers. The Business Activity Center, or BAC, stretches along McCrimmon Parkway from its intersection with Aviation Parkway to Airport Boulevard. The town also installed the Gateway Overlay Zoning District to regulate development in the area. Meanwhile, the Transit-Oriented Development Zoning District, or TOD, sits at the corner of McCrimmon Parkway and Chapel Hill Road. The AOD was installed in the 1990s to restrict development, particularly residential development, in an area of town subject to heavy and loud traffic going to and from the airport. But as the town grew, the district became increasingly attractive for further growth, and the town began planning changes. July's vote rezoned the McCrimmon Extension subarea into the Business Activity Center, allowing a mix of multifamily, retail, offices, and life sciences space. The council also approved a gateway overlay laying out regulations for developments proposed in the new district. The area is largely undeveloped, but also includes the Wake Competition Center and a few other businesses. The new TOD zoning envisions a much denser mixed-use hub to support existing and incoming transit options planned for that part of town. Filings with the town say the plan anticipates a mix of urban townhomes, multifamily, retail, service, restaurants, and hotels in the new district. Blackstone expands in Durham Industrial Park with $43 million deal. A New York investment giant has purchased its latest property in the Triangle with a more than $43 million deal for a massive industrial site in Durham. On August 24, an affiliate of New York-based Blackstone Real Estate paid $43.1 million for a 260,000-square-foot industrial building in the Regional Commerce Center. The deal is Blackstone's second acquisition in the industrial park. The property is situated on 35 acres at 805 South Briggs Avenue. Indianapolis developer Scannell Properties built the property in 2019 as part of its Regional Commerce Center project. Scannell bought the Regional Commerce Center in 2018 for $6.7 million from the Dilwag Companies. At the time, the property came complete with 48 vintage warehouses on 65 acres of land. Soon after, Scannell announced plans to redevelop the site into a 1.2 million square foot modern distribution and light industrial campus. The company filed plans for phase two of the development last fall, calling for three new buildings totaling a combined 295,000 square feet. National Builder plots a 232-home development. Earlier this year, Atlanta-based Pulte Group filed plans for Saunders Farms, calling for 232 homes in Fuquay Varina. The project is situated on 72.4 acres at 7621 South NC 55 on the southeast side of town. Filings with the town call for a mix of 92 single-family detached homes and 140 townhomes. The development will include 34.7 acres of open space. High-value property deals in Wake exploded in July. Very high-value property sales in Wake County skyrocketed in July, with a recent report by the Wake County Register of Deeds finding that the month saw $975 million worth of sales valued at more than $30 million. The county organizes sales in categories of very high value, those over $30 million, high value, $1 million to $30 million, and core market transactions, those below $1 million. And finally, we have a big number, $19 million. The amount paid by Austin-based BL Triangle LLC for the 120-unit Triangle Park Apartments in Durham, or $159,166 per unit. And now we turn to the On Greater Triangle Growth page, written by Evan Hoopfer. The first headline, Launch JOCO Targets Startups. Johnston County unveils new program to help entrepreneurs. As Johnston County grows, local leadership is looking to foster the community's entrepreneurs. The Clayton Chamber of Commerce is organizing a new program called Launch JoCo, designed to help small businesses grow. The program offers opportunities for local entrepreneurs to take classes at Johnston Community College's Small Business Center, as well as network and learn from business leaders in the community. The program is free. Launch JoCo is organized by the Clayton Chamber of Commerce, which is also working with the Benson and Triangle East Chambers. The chamber anticipates 30 participants will be part of the program each year and says Johnston County business owners can apply at claytonchamber.com/launchjoco, J-O-C-O. The chamber started fielding interest for entrepreneurs and mentors September 1, and interest appears to be high. Speaking that day, Dana Wooten, president of the Clayton Chamber of Commerce, says they have already received inquiries from prospective entrepreneurs. The plan is to accept applications through November and choose the participants before Thanksgiving, she says. Classes begin at the SBC's Entrepreneur Academy in January and run through April. Curriculum will include subjects like cash flow, marketing and advertising, bookkeeping, and social media. After the classes finish next spring, the mentoring aspect begins. Entrepreneurs will receive mentorship and be able to network with members of the local business community. A lot of times, small business owners and entrepreneurs get busy in their business, so we want to provide them an opportunity to work on their business, Wooten says. Project slated to bring over 500 homes to Moore County takes next step. A development that could bring over 500 homes to Moore County took another step recently. Aberdeen approved an annexation request for 131.37 acres during a town board meeting in late August. The land is part of the larger Martin Farms development that has plans for up to 515 homes and 38,000 square feet of retail and office space spread across 230 acres. The site is located next to the newly constructed Aberdeen Elementary School off NC Highway 5. Kidder Construction Incorporated, a home builder based in Banner Elk, near Boone, submitted the annexation request to the town. Kidder Construction has been involved with several housing developments in the western North Carolina mountains. National company makes industrial play in Fayetteville. A national real estate firm with properties across the East Coast just made a big investment in the Fayetteville area. Skyrem, spelled Sky, S-K-Y-R-E-M, LLC, acquired approximately 360 acres in Cedar Creek Industrial Park from Cumberland County, the parties announced in late August. The purchase price will be $10,000 an acre for a total of around $3.6 million, which could be adjusted slightly after the land is surveyed. The project has the potential for 1.6 million square feet of industrial space. A condition of the transaction is for Skyrem to build a facility that's at least 40,000 square feet within 3 years of the sale. And in a section called He Said It, a quote from Jay Lewis, division president for Dan Ryan Builders in Raleigh. His firm recently bought 20 acres in Harnett County with plans for 111 home sites. The world used to stop at Cary, then it became Apex, then it became Holly Springs. Now Fuquay Varina is fully in play as a good, solid address for people to live and commute to employment centers. Same thing with Anger. And finally, a big number, $11.5 million. The amount Vermont-based Sterling Legacy paid for Highland Vista apartment homes in Creedmoor in a bet that growth from Wake and Durham counties will go north. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we have a special report on the return of business travel. The headline, Fourth and a Long Road to Recovery. A month ago, hotels and airlines were readying for the final quarter with the wind at their backs. But with COVID flaring, they find themselves scrambling to bridge what may be another long winter. Bleisure travel, anyone? And this is written by Craig M. Douglas. The summer of doldrums with a strong assist from the COVID-19 Delta variant have stalled what was shaping up to be a recovery for the ages in the travel and hospitality industries. The past few weeks sum things up. On August 25, American Airlines Incorporated joined peers including Southwest Airlines Incorporated, Frontier Airlines, and Spirit Airlines by walking back revenue expectations for the month, citing the recent global rise in COVID cases. A day earlier, the National Rifle Association alerted its 5 million plus members that it was canceling its annual meeting scheduled in Houston during the Labor Day weekend, also due to COVID. A week before that, country music star Garth Brooks cited the virus's spread in canceling 5 shows in September and October, part of his comeback U.S. stadium tour. Things were supposed to be different. An analysis by the business journals of daily flight data highlighted December as the month when air carriers expected domestic travel to surge above and beyond pre-pandemic levels. As of August 3rd, domestic flights for the final month of the year were scheduled to number 751,229, about 2% higher than what was recorded during the same period in 2019. But in 2 weeks, those numbers had changed for the negative, a shift still gaining momentum as we went to press. An August 26 follow-up analysis of the same 31-day period identified a 5% drop, about 30,000 flights, from what carriers had scheduled earlier in the month, according to data supplied by Cirium Incorporated, a provider of airline industry research and analysis. For some of the nation's major travel hubs, the changes will be material. Approximately 12% of the December flights originating from Hartsfield-Jackson Atlanta International Airport, the nation's busiest, were eliminated during that three-week span. Chicago O'Hare's International Airport saw a 6% decrease, and Detroit Metro Airport, Minneapolis-St. Paul International Airport, George Bush Intercontinental Airport in Houston, and San Francisco International Airport joined the other hubs to see at least 1,000 flights eliminated from the December manifest. As air travel goes, so too goes the hotel sector, which does not bode well for hoteliers preparing for 2021's final quarter. A separate analysis by the business journals of flight and hotel capacities in major U.S. cities between January 1 and June 30 showed a strong correlation between the two, with popular leisure travel destinations such as Phoenix and Florida's Miami, Fort Lauderdale, and Tampa fast approaching flight traffic and room occupancy on par with pre-pandemic levels. Conversely, cities with little leisure travel during the first two quarters of the year, New York, Boston, San Francisco, and San Jose, California included, were also among the airline and hotel markets with the weakest recoveries to date. Bottom line, should the fourth quarter outlook continue to deteriorate for the nation's air carriers, hotel operators might do well to prepare. Winter is coming. And now we'll turn to the executive voice column. It's concerning Eric Johnson. And in a section called A Closer Look, Eric Johnson, hometown Winston-Salem, residence, Raleigh, education, NC State University, first ever job, playing in a band in high school, family, wife, 3 kids, and a grandson. The headline, his successful path is not typical. Trailblazer finds a fit for his talent in Raleigh. And this article is written by Lauren Onasorge. Instinct would have had a man with Eric Johnson's goals packing up and heading off for Los Angeles decades ago. But Johnson isn't a guy who follows the typical paths to success. In addition to serving as senior vice president of sound and engagement at Trailblazer Studios in Raleigh, he also advises the state on its film recruitment strategy as part of the governor's advisory council on film, television, and digital streaming. But Johnson didn't start out in the industry. Instead, he was working with artists, running his own music production firm, John Sound Productions, for nearly 2 decades. I initially thought I was going to be the next Quincy Jones, he says. But there was a big kink in that plan. Today's record producers have to head to the West Coast and the shining lights of Los Angeles. Johnson, however, wanted to stay right where he was. I absolutely wanted to stay in Raleigh, he says. His vision changed over the years. Johnson never stopped loving music, but the big and small screen called to him. He calls it a stroke of luck that post-production studio Trailblazer happened to set up shop in Raleigh when its CEO, Tom Waring, moved here from Texas, offering an opportunity to dive into the industry, starting with videos for GlaxoSmithKline and Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina, and culminating in television documentary projects. It's kind of a one-in-a-million situation, Johnson says. We've been really fortunate. It hasn't been an overnight success by any means, but we've worked hard. And that includes working with TLC on numerous shows, thanks to a partnership with Figure 8 Films of Carrboro. At Trailblazer, he also has packed local initiatives such as He has also backed local initiatives such as the Full Frame Festival in Durham, which awarded him the 2021 Full Frame Advocate Award. In his career, Johnson has worked on a number of projects that have appeared in a slew of places, from Sundance to HBO and Netflix. And a look at his IMDb page shows a commitment to diversity on the screen. His recent projects have included The Legacy of Black Wall Street and Rise Again, Tulsa and the Red Summer. Johnson's favorite projects are those that make a difference or shed light on information that we don't know until it's explored in the film or show, he says. And diversity isn't just a film subject to Johnson. It's the way he sees his industry growing in North Carolina. Right now, much of the work Trailblazer does involves partnerships with production companies outside the state. But in a year where North Carolina is seeing record industry spending, Johnson sees more opportunities for work closer to home. The key, however, is for North Carolina to differentiate, and to do that, it needs diverse talent. We need to do whatever we need to do to attract and develop diverse talent, he says. More and more major studios are looking for diverse crew members, even going so far as to mandate it as a priority. And Johnson sees North Carolina's ability to answer that call as a way to build more business, particularly as the pandemic has proved to West Coast studios that remote work in the field is doable. North Carolina has always been attractive to the film industry, just our diversity of terrain and shooting locations, he says. But I really think that we haven't fully reached our potential. The prevailing thought process is you have to pack up and move to LA to be successful. That was very true for a good bit of time, but we're starting to see that's not really the case. A lack of studio space and crew, however, is a major barrier. The crew's not coming back until there's enough work, and some of the work isn't coming until they feel there's enough crew, Johnson says. He says there are other challenges to the industry, however, and a big one is politics, particularly where film incentives are concerned. Johnson believes those not in favor of incentives don't understand the full picture. There's some education that needs to happen, he says. Film isn't just multi-million dollar actors and directors. It's very blue-collar crew positions. Like it or not, a lot of film production is driven by incentives. Johnson says the state needs to be able to compete with states such as Georgia that are aggressively looking to lure Hollywood business. And he says the state needs to be particularly aggressive with series, not just feature films. It's great to have a feature film, but they're here for several months and the film is done, Johnson says. But when you have a series that shoots for years and years and years, people begin to move here. They set up homes. They begin paying taxes. But for a studio network to commit to an area for a series, they need to not be in fear that incentives are going to change or disappear based on the political climate. And now we turn to the Viewpoint page, where we read the Editor's Notebook, written by Sugata Mukherjee, who's editor-in-chief of the Triangle Business Journal. The headline, Real Estate's Achilles Heel, Too Many Subleases. I saw a poll recently commissioned by accounting giant PwC in August that concluded more than 40% of workers never want to go back to work at their offices. That's up from 29% in January. Another PwC survey done earlier stated that 22% of executives prefer limited or no work-from-home schedules, and only 24% expect most employees to work remotely for a significant amount of time. There's a disconnect, and guess what? The disconnect between employers and employees is getting wider. Given how workers are willing to leave companies to work for others with more location flexibility and perhaps more pay, the writing is on the wall as to who wins in the end. All the momentum toward return-to-work strategies during the second quarter of the year has vanished dramatically during the beginning weeks of the third quarter. And as numbers show, it is now tilting toward employers beginning to devise permanent plans to set up an office culture with work-from-home planted front and center. In its weekly office building occupancy report in early July, Castle Systems, which keeps track of building security access data, reported the national average occupancy of office buildings stood at 32.7%, a number that was expected to be substantially higher by now. By August, Castle reported the occupancy number was even lower. However, the survey noted there was a slight uptick in occupancy during the August 24 week. A survey done just days ago by Gartner showed 66% of the employers have delayed reopening their offices. This has resulted in office buildings across the U.S. showing an increasing number of offices where leaseholders are asking property managers to search for a company to sublease its office space. In the Raleigh-Durham metro area, only 13% of vacant space was available for sublease before the pandemic hit. During the June ending quarter this year, That number ballooned to 26%, and it is likely to go up even more when third quarter numbers come out. So if there's so much of existing commercial space available, what happens to the new construction of office towers? Developers continue to argue that there's not much to worry about because metros such as Raleigh, Austin, Texas, Nashville, Tennessee, Phoenix, and a few others are experiencing a net gain of jobs and people moving in. True, but there's a problem with that theory. For one, these companies may require much smaller office spaces because they are resigned to the fact that a good part of their workforce will be remote. And two, in order to control costs, the sublease space may be the first one to go because leaseholders are interested in getting the cost off their books. If I were a builder of apartments, townhomes, and condominiums, I would add office nooks in the design of these new spaces. That's because if remote work is here to stay, it is more than likely that companies would pick up some of the costs related to home offices. So a $1,300 monthly rental could be $1,000 because employers will pick up $300 a month. That by itself is far cheaper than $35 per foot or a $45 per foot office space lease in the long term. Like anything, there would be challenges to this dramatic shift, issues relating to electronic security, imagine the corporate networks trying to grant access from all over, and the need to keep workers engaged through collaboration and recognition. It's not the same with Zoom or Teams, and the need for managers to meet team members during emergencies. We will all learn to adapt, so will the commercial real estate industry. And also on the Viewpoint page, we have a column written by Dr. Cameron Wolf. The headline, Understanding the Merits of COVID Booster. Dr. Cameron Wolf is an infectious disease specialist at Duke Health and an associate professor at the Duke University School of Medicine. A third booster dose of Pfizer and Moderna vaccines has been approved for some immune-compromised people and appears likely to be available later this year for a broader general American population. Duke University infectious disease specialist Dr. Cameron Wolf discusses the booster, who should get it, who should wait, and what variables you should weigh when considering it. On a third COVID shot for the immunocompromised, it's important because it's all singularly in the direction of improving vaccine responses in these individuals. It's clear that we're trying to carve out a group of individuals who we know to be at severe risk of COVID. A severe high risk of COVID. We know on average their response is poorer to vaccines, so we're trying to give them a little bit more. That is exactly what we do each year with someone who gets a flu vaccine. We are deliberately putting those individuals ahead of the rest of the general population. On booster shots being available more widely soon? What we're starting to see is that there is a diminished protection that we're seeing at the moment in individuals who were vaccinated many months ago. When we talk about boosting for individuals in the general community, I want to be very clear that to me, that is far less important than still reaching those individuals who are not yet vaccinated at all. We need to see much more data to see what the benefits of boosting is to the overarching general population who are lower risk. A 35-year-old who has gone through and had your two doses of Pfizer vaccine, for example, really has no risk of severe COVID and isn't in a frontline healthcare working situation. That's different. I think we need to see a little bit more data to fully understand why that person needs to be boosted. Is a booster the same as the first shots? What we're talking about is the same dose you had before. There's no difference. The dose is exactly the same. It is important to give it right now, or is it better to wait? In fact, for a variant booster, that may help us more against current or future variants, but might take longer to get. The risk is now. On waiting the right interval of time before getting the booster? The timing is important because sometimes waiting a little bit extra time is appropriate to gain the strongest possible response. The endpoint has to be the prevention of infection and the prevention of hospitalization. So you don't need to do that earlier. I don't think, for example, there's a great reason for an otherwise healthy individual who was just vaccinated with Pfizer or Moderna 2 months ago to go back and offer them a third shot, absent some other medical condition, because they will have great protection. On boosting with a different vaccine from the first doses? To some extent, the answer is that we know what the safety data is. We're following the third being the same as the second and the first. It's not that we know that there's damaging or safety data aplenty in people who had mixed courses. It's just that we don't know what the data is. And now we turn to our our general news stories. First article by Lauren Onasorge. AI report is high on the triangle. Raleigh could become major player for AI careers in the future. Could Raleigh one day become a hub for artificial intelligence? A new study says there's a strong chance. The report out of the think tank Brookings Institution identifies the Raleigh Metro as one of AI's early adopters and a sizable competitor as the industry matures. Brookings researcher Mark Murrow says the results of the report show potentially big opportunities for the Triangle. In addition to the region's ability to leverage federal research funding, the report called out the AI-related job listings in the region. Murrow says his research found that job postings are an important measure of commercial activity, and Raleigh looks very strong, he says. In fact, it's one of the few places that's as strong for actual job creation and hiring as it is for federal research, he says. Numbers compiled by Brookings show one AI job posting for every 100 workers in the Raleigh Metro. It shows nearly 54 AI patents per million workers. And in terms of AI-related R&D dollars, it finds that the Raleigh Metro sees more than $146 per worker. While it pales in comparison to the biggest tech hubs, San Francisco, for example, sees more than $478 in AI-related R&D dollars per worker. It's comparable on many fronts to the cities it competes with the most when it comes to tech firms' relocations and expansions, particularly when it comes to AI job postings. Austin, Texas, for example, sees 1.3 jobs per 100 workers, and Boston is at 1.5 jobs per 100 workers. It remains to be seen how the pandemic may factor into the Triangle's future as an AI cluster, but early signs point to continued strength, particularly when compared to California. Data on job postings amid the pandemic show the number actually tickled down in the Bay Area, but up in the metros identified as early adopters, including Raleigh. Murrow says that while it's early, that could signal a reorientation away from Silicon Valley and toward places like Raleigh. It's not a full trend yet, but it looks like there has been some uptick in places like Raleigh, he says. Raleigh looks like a super competitive location compared to anybody in this field. The report points to major Raleigh area employers as leading the way, specifically IBM, Oracle, Deloitte, Lenovo, and Applied Research Associates. New hotel in the works for busy Raleigh Shopping Center. This article written by Erica Wells. A hotel could be in the works for a popular shopping center in Midtown Raleigh. The Village District, formerly Cameron Village, owner Regency Centers Corporation has filed a rezoning request with the city to allow for a proposed development on a portion of 2016 Cameron Street, according to the rezoning application. The hotel would be situated near the intersection of Woodburn Road and Smallwood Drive and cover 1.13 acres. The site includes the former location of K&W Cafeteria, which closed last summer amid the pandemic. The conditional use rezoning request is consistent with nearby development plans. The area is zoned for community mixed use for buildings up to five floors high, but the applicant is seeking to add a seven-story hotel. The city's comprehensive plan states structures may reach up to 12 stories based on the current zoning designation, according to the application. The rezoning request is reasonable and in the public interest because it facilitates the development of a hotel use within a shopping center area, thereby providing a greater mix of uses and a hospitality use that is walkable to retail and restaurant amenities, according to the application. Nearby hotels include a Loft Raleigh and DoubleTree by Hilton along Hillsborough Street and Hampton Inn and Suites in Glenwood South. The proposed hotel comes as the hospitality sector in Wake County continues its slow recovery amid the pandemic. In the second quarter, hotel occupancy was 52% in the county, an over 11% increase year to date, according to the latest report from the Greater Raleigh Convention and Visitors Bureau, Visit Raleigh. That's on track with the state average of 54.7% and 53.8% nationally. Numbers for the second quarter are still lower than expected due to COVID-19, Visit Raleigh says, but they continue to climb. Hotel lodging tax collections were $9.1 million through June, up $1.42 million over 2020, according to the report. Visit Raleigh and the Greater Raleigh Sports Alliance, GRSA, hosted 50 events in Q2, bringing in about 39,000 attendees to the area. Both organizations booked 60 future events for about 45,000 room nights, a future business to Wake County, with a projected $18.8 million economic impact. However, the rise in COVID cases due to the Delta variant could further strain travel. Wetlands caused Smithfield project to reduce scope. This is written by Evan Hoopfer. Nearly 500 acres south of downtown Smithfield could one day be home to almost 2,000 homes. Developer Ray Perkins and his group, NRP Ventures LLC, plan to hold a call for offers on the land September 10. Previous plans called for the assemblage to be 1,200 acres, but the group had to downsize because a large chunk of the land was too wet to build upon, says Tim Peters of Raleigh-based Property Resources, who's handling the listing. We've had quite a bit of interest on it from home developers and some master developers, Peters says. The 492 contiguous acres sit south of downtown Smithfield near Interstate 95. According to preliminary plans drawn up by Timmins Group, space exists for up to 1,990 housing units through a mix of single-family homes, multifamily complexes, and townhomes. Although Peters previously said they were looking for $33,250 per acre, he now says the plan is to let the market determine pricing. Perkins had planned to bring the assemblage to around 2,000 acres before dropping it to 1,200 acres after getting feedback from potential buyers. Now in the Triangle Business Journal, we have the Business Pulse Survey. The question, what will the Triangle's housing market look like a year from now? There were 362 responses. 57% say home values will be climbing. 35% say home values will have leveled off. And 8% believe home values will be falling. And with our remaining time, we'll turn to the small business section to read James Lee's column. He's a family business speaker, advisor, and author. The headline, Boards Play Crucial Role for Family Businesses. Over the past 25 years or so, I've taken to my pulpit several times on the subject of board of directors of family-owned companies and why some of them are so ineffective as corporate advisors and governors. Columns and platforms talk about directors' accountability have drawn responses from executives, family members, and directors themselves that range from keep on telling it like it is to how'd you like the seven of us to meet you in the parking lot after dark? When that many balloons go up, I figure I'm onto something, so my instinct for self-preservation notwithstanding, maybe it's useful to look at another point where family business boards can run into serious trouble when it's time for important changes in strategy, policy, or management. And we'll have to stop there, but the column continues to explain that non-family members should be included on the boards where appropriate. And we have run out of time for today's episode. I hope you enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Triangle Business Journal is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. So long until next time, and thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.